Investors Chronicle.
Companies and Market Show. Welcome back, everyone. It is Thursday, the 8th of December, as we record. Joining us on today's show, Julian Hoffman. Hi, Julian.
Hello, John. Nice to see you again.
And Alex Newman. Hello, Alex.
Hi, John.
And as normal, hosting Dan Jones. Dan, what is coming up on today's show?
Hi, John. Today we are starting with a UK lender, Paragon, slightly different from some of the other UK lenders. We're going to be looking at its recent results. Then we are going to talk about our cover feature this week, which is on the property market and housing and the question of what people in a situation where they might be looking to buy or sell in the near future should be thinking at the moment. And finally, we're going to turn to another result, Moonpig, altogether a less promising performer in recent months. And we're going to expand that out a little bit to look at some of the 2023 prospects for companies like Moonpig, but also companies that reported in recent weeks what they're saying about the year ahead.
Sounds good, Dan. Before then, a quick news roundup from the week that's been. First up, recent data has found that the outlook for retail and hospitality this Christmas is not looking all that rosy. The likes of the British Retail Consortium and KPMG point to rising costs and falling consumer spending as reasons for caution. On the other hand, the British Beer and Pub Association has reported the ongoing FIFA World Cup has given boozers a boost. England's recent match against Senegal saw the industry sell an extra 5 million pints compared to a regular Sunday. On Monday, we had news that the Vodafone chief executive Nick Reed has resigned after 4 years in the job. It came after the telecoms giant downgraded its full-year profit and cash flow guidance last month. Mining giant Glencore has agreed to a payout deal with the Democratic Republic of Congo for $180 million. It's for, quote, any alleged acts of corruption. It takes Glencore's 2022 bribery and corruption penalties to almost $1.7 billion after deals with US, UK and Brazilian authorities. Electrical retailer Currys has stopped using Royal Mail as postal workers prepare for 6 days of strikes. The CEO, Alex Baldock, said parcels are easily switchable to another provider. Royal Mail reported a £219 million operating loss in the 6 months to the 25th of September, and management insists that it needs to cut 5,000 full-time roles by next spring. British American Tobacco shares fell 2% after CEO Jack Bowles warned of volume pressures in the US market. He did, however, maintain that he is confident that full-year guidance will be achieved. And online estate agency Purple Bricks has posted more losses and admitted it could be liable to pay a fine following, quote, instances of non-compliance with regulation. The instances in question were found during an internal review and they await the regulatory oversight. That's all from me. Back to you, Dan, for the rest of the show.
So, Paragon. Julian, we'll start with you. I know this is a company you've followed for a while. It just had its figures out, pretty decent figures, and also quite notably for a bank, one that's focused to an extent on buy-to-let lending, it's still sounding pretty chipper about the year ahead.
Yes, that's right. I mean, Alex also knows Nigel Terrington. He's quite a character, I think, in that sector. So I don't think he'd be anything less than chipper about his own company. But what was noticeable was that Paragon, unlike some other specialist lenders, seems to have maintained its grip on the buy-to-let market at the same time as sort of diversifying the business quite successfully. So they're getting a double benefit from it. So, you know, they're getting the rate rise margin boost that all banks are getting, but they seem to be getting this little finish on the top where they're still earning quite good money in the buy-to-let market. And the SME lending business is also seems to be doing very well. So, I mean, that was a diversification thing they did a few years ago, and they've developed that. And for my money, it's a very well-run type of it's a well-run, not specialist lender that's outside of the mainstream, but It acts also in a funny way as a kind of bellwether for that particular sector. I think Alex would agree on that. But and then they also had decent, unlike say pension funds who had to pay out all their capital for LDI liabilities, they actually did quite well out of derivatives contracts. So they're like 190 million up just from positive derivative movements. But it looks like they'll have to give that back anyway once the rates normalize over the next couple of years. But yes, overall, a really interesting business. And they've been going for years, and I imagine that they'll continue in the same vein. I don't know, Alex. I mean, you know them quite well as well, I think. Isn't that right?
It's been a couple of years since I was covering the banking beat, but I think in the interim, the point you alluded to there has been quite interesting, just looking through the results in their diversification push. So I think it is fair to say, you know, buy-to-let is still the majority of the loan book, but their push into commercial lending, SME, being very selective with their, with the loans they're making, is a smart move from a diversification purposes. But I mean, even with the buy-to-let market, and you know, we can obviously come onto that and talk about a lot about property today. But I mean, it's a very different beast to the high street banks. And you know, if you look at just the sort of backdrop to the normal mortgage market, it's such a political subject. There's so much sensitivity around the rates at which banks offer their products, and it's operating in a slightly more commercial part of the market is I think to their advantage, although there are definite risks there, even with a kind of professional buy-to-let borrower base that they work with.
Yeah, and also, I mean, they just don't have any cost, do they, by contrast? I mean, they seem to manage, if you're a mainstream bank, you struggle to get your cost ratio down below 65%. And I mean, they seem to be well below that. I mean, I guess it helps that they don't have like 1,000 branches that nobody uses. So that seems to be the way to go.
Yeah. I think if there's one concern you would have about them is their reliance on retail savings market. So I mean, what the high street banks have got going for them is an ability to somehow maintain these enormous. I was looking at Lloyds. They have hundreds of billions in UK savings of their deposits are UK savings accounts, which yield almost nothing. But they seem to cling on to this business, even though there are much better places for retail customers to place their savings. But I think Harrogan has obviously pivoted to that market, which is very active, and they can get huge inflows, with the launch of fixed income products at the drop of a hat. But it's quite flighty. So I would be slightly nervous if I was an investor at a couple of points that they announced in the results this week. One being the fact that the term of their fixed interest retail savings accounts has come down slightly. 22 months is average, so you know they've got a bit of a breathing space. But at the same time, the average interest rate is about 1.7% on those accounts. If you're one of these saving accounts shoppers, you know that there are better deals on the market now, and you'd be looking to switch. They have to respond very nimbly to those pressures. So that's just one bare point I would mention.
Yeah, I mean, and also they're looking at the buy-to-let market next year with some caution, I think, in some ways. I mean, yeah, they booked some impairments, but that they weren't anything to do. Interestingly, he told me that there wasn't anything to do with the current book. It was what they kind of felt might happen next year, which they seem to be quite marginal. It's like barely £15 million worth of possible impairments. But I thought that was an interesting point you made. That you know, it's probably not all a one-way bet. You just have to choose which one you have to put your money on, really.
Yeah,
but there we go.
Yeah, and that, I suppose, in that buy-to-let book, as well as you mentioned, Alex, you know, they do target the more professional landlords who, according to their own research, admittedly, but they seem to be the ones who are staying more committed to the market. You know, the pressures right now on buy-to-let lending rates seem to be having a greater impact on smaller landlords. So, you know, potentially there's the ability to withstand some difficulties there. I mean, when I think of Paragon, I often think back to 2008, as I suppose people do with most banks in the UK. You know, those memories loom large still to an extent. But do we think, you know, that back then obviously is a very different situation. It's, I think we can hopefully assume that next year won't be anything like that. But we are going into a bit of a downturn again. Last time, you know, there was a rescue rights issue from Paragon. Clearly, they're nowhere near that situation. Book is looking quite good, as discussed. Do we think they've kind of learned lessons from that period as well, in terms of how, what they focus on and how they, you know, focus on credit quality, as we say?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think the credit quality has probably improved, doesn't it? And also the proportion of risk-weighted assets is moving in their favour. So, you know, whatever the Basel banking rules are now. From our point of view, I think, you know, they're quite well capitalized, for historically well capitalized, and unless there's a total disaster in, you know, there's, I mean, that thing that Alex was alluding to, where there might be capital flight combined with some sort of underlying asset decline in asset quality, that might be the perfect storm for a company like Paragon. But in a sense, they've done the best they can to avoid the, what, you know, they've done the best they can to avoid the last crisis. So maybe that would put them in good stead for the next one. But
I think one thing you could definitely, I mean, I think one of the reasons is from memory, so it might be, you know, slightly hazy, but one of the reasons they had a bad crisis along with all the other banks is that they were one of the principal issuers of UK of residential mortgage backed securities. And that was obviously, you know, one of the detonators in the GFC. So, I mean, that market has really kind of vanished in recent years. So there's not that danger. But yeah, I mean, just to go back to the point on, I mean, the point on the retail savings market is, I think, is going to be manageable for them. It's just, it might mean that it moves against their net interest margins, you know, faster over a one-year period than it might do for some of the other of the larger banks. I mean, I think it's something they can certainly manage. And you know, the other thing, I think they'll probably be having very, very active discussions with their borrowers on, you know, how much cash they have set aside in the good years for buy-to-let landlords. And we'll see, you know, how well those professional landlords have been preparing their own balance sheets in the next year. And, you know, that, you know, how that has played out will determine how Paragon's loan book, you know, credit quality holds up.
On which note, we should turn to our cover feature this week. I'll stick with Paragon for a moment, though, because their sort of central scenario does provide some hard forecasts for the year ahead, which are, you know, always interesting to look at from this vantage point, however accurate or otherwise they prove. I think they're assuming GDP down 1.1%, CPI 11.9% next year, which, you know, is perhaps the most interesting of these three figures, and house prices down 8.2%. Our cover feature this week does look at the housing market and, you know, gloomier prospects there. Julian, why don't we start with you, because you're in the fortunate position of having recently sold a property, and perhaps with that in mind as well, you're you know, relatively downbeat on the prospects for the year ahead. Of course, as we get into in the piece, there are regional nuances and variations depending on your, you know, your ability to buy and where you are in life, where you're in the market. But why don't we start from a broad view with your take on housing, the UK market next year?
Yeah, I mean, we only managed to flog it because we knocked like 25,000 off it. So it wasn't a total success. There is a clearly demand. I mean, it wasn't hard in that sense. It was arduous in that people kept coming along, and then their mortgage deals kept disappearing. That was one issue. So there's the, I'm wondering whether that will continue next year, or at least continue in an accelerated way as rates go up, because obviously people budget for a certain level, and when it comes to it, the mortgage company says, no, sorry, you can't do that. So you wonder whether that will help to stagnate the market, or whether that will cause the market more to stagnate, because they're just, it's not that there isn't demand, it's just that there isn't, that they can't match the demand to the financing. So you can see that scenario playing out quite repetitively over the coming year. And I think it also depends where you are. I mean, it wasn't, you know, in a London borough with a tube station down the road, in relative terms, it's not going to be difficult to sell anything. Whereas if you want to buy a trophy property in Cornwall with no services at the end of the A30, my feeling is you're not going to find it so easy to get rid of it, particularly if you bought it in a hurry in the pandemic to escape the lockdowns. But so there's those regional differences are going to come in quite markedly, I think. And
well, one of the reasons we did this piece was because there are some interesting dynamics right now in terms of, you know, time and time lags. I think insofar as you might think now is an awful time to buy a property, you know, certainly versus recent years, if you're viewing it on a short-term price appreciation point of view, which is of course not really the way you should view property anyway, if it's a roof over your head. But at the same time, you know, mortgage rates have got ahead of base rates. You know, they obviously shot up in September with the mini budget, and there is a suggestion, you know, the argument that they may pretty much have peaked already, which is something I've thought for a few weeks, and so far that's kind of held firm. We'll see how long that lasts into next year. But with a rate already effectively debating a Bank of England base rate in excess of 4%, maybe even 5%, you know, it might be that the point of peak pain is here. What that means next year for the market is a different question, I suppose. But it might be that, you know, waiting a month or two will get you a better mortgage rate, will get you the, if you're a buyer, will get you the ability to have a discount on the property, as you found, Julian. And if you're looking to the long term, you need to move, then, you know, why not move?
Well, great. You know, it'll just take us back to 2005, which was an infinitely better year in my view. But it has to correct. I mean, there's no question about it. I mean, it's going to force it, whether the rates have peaked or not. It's going to, there will be an attritional effect, whatever happens. I think that's a slightly, you know, a specious debate, really. But
it seems the consensus certainly is there will be a decent price correction next year. Alex, what's your view?
Yeah, I mean, a couple of things here. I mean, like you said, there are so many hypotheticals, and it's hard to sketch out the question of timing and property purchases, in a sort of universal soundbite, which will be meaningful to everyone who might be on either side of a transaction. At one point you could say, should you wait to buy a property? It might sound like a bit of a trite question to be asking. You know, if you've been wanting to buy a home and you've been desperate to do so in recent months, and things are only going to get more desperate, really. I mean, it's a very difficult position with rents so high as they are relative to income. That depresses further prospective buyers' ability to save. So that's not a great position to be in. And I imagine there you just want to buy a property if you can, and you're not looking to time anything. The question on timing, really, with the housing market, is you've got to assume that everyone is trying to time things to a degree. I mean, life, you know, everyone's life circumstances mean that they are, you know, you might be making a purchase or selling because of whatever's going on in your life. But people do kind of act in a very herd-like way in markets. And if the dynamic we see at the moment is that, you know, things are obviously clearly a lot less competitive than they were a few months ago, I suppose the risk is, you know, the longer you wait, you know, to take the flip side of your what you mentioned, Dan, about rates potentially peaking, it might not pan out that way. I mean, one big risk I think potentially could be coming next year is another loss of faith in the government's fiscal regime. Okay, we're not going to have a repeat of the mini budget, but since Sunak and Hunt took over, we've had very calm waters, and, you know, yields at sort of their highest level since the financial crisis can be called calm in the gilt market. But, you know, if there was going to be a sudden loss of confidence in how and who is going to buy all the government debt that needs to be issued next year, you know, things could pan out, you know, badly if you're thinking of sitting on the fence and hoping that Lloyds is going to bring their 2-year fix down from 6.5 to 5. I mean, I suspect there's a reason for the high street banks holding the rates at the levels they are at the moment. It's not just because they're being really mean and not wanting to pass on, you know, net interest savings to customers. So yeah, it's a really delicate balance, I think, at the moment. But assume everyone else is trying to time it as well, is the only thing I'd say.
Yeah, I think that's definitely fair on rates. You know, maybe like with inflation, perhaps, you know, maybe that the peak is in, but it could equally take a very long time for them to come down meaningfully. We do touch on a lot of aspects in the piece as best we can. One other factor which lends itself to something you were saying, Gillian, is downsizing. You know, people who already have a property who might be considering moving or, you know, moving down. Certainly demographically, a lot of people will be in that boat. I think maybe a lack of suitable housing is an issue there, but also now, you know, they may not want to crystallize what presumably are some decent gains at this time as well, which all plays into the kind of the inertia factor. You know, we've already had a year where there's been very little property on the market, even relative to post-crisis levels, and with a large proportion of UK homeowners having no mortgage at all, there is no incentive to move there either. There's not going to be no financial pressure. So, I mean, in some ways, that if you're again looking purely on a price basis, that could help, you know, avoid price discovery, and therefore there won't be too much of a move. But it doesn't necessarily speak to a well-functioning property market at the same time if there's simply no transactions at all. So yeah, it's a difficult one.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, where we live in the Southwest, it's like everyone objects to everything being built, so there's no supply coming onto the market either. So you've got that. Yeah, it's not, you know, there's a dysfunction. There's a natural dysfunction there anyway. And obviously, if we couldn't really downsize anymore, we'd probably have to move into the garage if that were the case. But ideally, we need to upsize. But I'm not sure how that's going to happen at the moment. Yeah, but it's not. You can't easily say what the impact of rates is if the underlying market is not functional. I think that's there might be a completely different incentive from now on, maybe because, you know, all the people who have no mortgages are starting to, you know, retire and need nursing care. I mean, that might be the next big liquidation, you know, the great baby boomer liquidation might be just around the corner, but you know, that might have an impact.
Yeah, well, we should move on from property for now. As I say, this is the cover feature this week. There's a lot of nuance and specifics in there, so do have a look if that takes your interest. Now, though, we're going to talk about Moonpig, which is a completely different kind of business. Again, not necessarily the most positive story over the last year, by which I mean it's had a horrible time of things. The latest figures aren't much better. I mean, it's really caught between two terrible issues from its perspective of one, you know, dwindling consumer demand, and two, the inability for its products to reach doors with continued Royal Mail strikes.
Well, I think the fact that I haven't received my last three Investor Chronicle magazines tells you the problems that Moonpig might be having in terms of getting the product out there. So yes, they've got that issue. Yeah, unless they set up their own distribution network for the entire country, they have to rely on the Royal Mail. So as soon as the Royal Mail sorts out its strike issues, then that will actually be an immediate benefit for Moonpig. They should get their volumes back up to a certain level. The other one is harder to call, because I mean, I was looking back through the copy of this, and they had been a very early beneficiary of the pandemic. Benefit.
Yeah, lockdown winners. I
think lockdown winners, exactly, yeah. And that effect lasted quite a long time. I think she'd more than people expected. And it's only really in the last couple of quarters that has started to wear off. And I don't know, you know, it could be just that people got into the habit of sending these things and and then suddenly realized they could all go shopping without having to wear a mask, and they could buy greeting cards that way. So they had a long, you might say, a long pandemic, and then as soon as that start that effect wore off, they got this distribution issue, and you know, it's just flattened the share price over the last year. I think they're down more than 60% year to date. But I mean, it's in a way you have to start asking the question whether there isn't a value case though, because it's still a business that, despite its issues, is generating margins of 54-55%, and that is pretty, you know, with all that background, that is pretty impressive. And you know, the shares have fallen so much that you know, the value case must start to kick in, you know, as a sort of recovery buy before long. I mean, I don't know exactly, you know, when the timing of that is, but you know, if you decided to pick them up in the new year, and it's a third presidential year, as I think Simon Thompson was saying the other day, you can't lose money in the stock market in the third year of a
he did say that, yeah.
So there might be some bearing on that for Moonpig, you never know. But yeah, I mean, I've always thought that, you know, they started off with a very high valuation. You know, it's a classic growth company with a story, it's an AIM, you know, AIM story. And it's almost that, like, now is where it's hitting the reality, where you know, the valuation is catching up with the reality of the business case. And actually, that is quite an interesting point for an investor to look at, I think. At least that would be my take on it.
I think beyond Democratic senators sending each other greetings cards, congratulating one another on holding the Senate, I think the growth story that was sold at IPO, so they IPO'd at the beginning of 2021, obviously off the back of a very, very strong year, as you say, is definitely kind of stuttered. I think, yeah, I mean, for me, the value case is a little harder to see here. And there's a reason why they've derated so spectacularly, because I think they're struggling to communicate where the growth is going to come from next. Though, no, I was looking into this before we started recording. I mean, my anecdotal sense is that younger generations send greeting cards less frequently, but apparently it's not so. And there's a lot of hope within the greeting cards. Millennials are going to rescue it, because they do send more than Gen Xers, or, you know, grumpy 40, 50-year-olds. And that there is potentially a growth story there, which might support a brave value investor. But I think it's a little bit hard to make the case very forcefully that Moonpig is going back to the moon where it started when it relisted.
Yeah, it's, I mean, they started off way too porky, really, in terms of the valuation there. So yeah. I had to get that in.
Yeah, that is an interesting growth case, though, Alex, because, yeah, as you say, and as Julian says, a lot of the factors right now, you know, out of their hands, you know, both coming off the pandemic boom, but also, you know, Royal Mail. Mm. There is a business underneath it all, which is looking quite good. But the question is, yeah, how much of that growth was just pulled forward or, you know, entirely artificial in the pandemic? It's hard to say, but that is interesting. You know, I mean, people like me sometimes, especially this time of year, when you get a bit harried for time and you need to send a load of cards online, can be the quick option. But I'm not sure that's an anecdote on which to build a business, but there is something there, perhaps.
I mean, the other thing, you know, and it's very trite to sort of sum up millennials. Look, you always see companies or investors talk about, you know, generational cohorts as if they're a monolith. Mm. But if there's one other thing that, you know, they do bang on about millennials or younger consumers is their, you know, is the appeal of authenticity in their consumption habits. I wonder if a kind of, you know, click your card online and send it out at a quite high price point without necessarily the personal touch means that sort of younger card givers are necessarily going to flock to Moonpig, even if they are sending greeting cards.
I thought millennials were all about quality stationery and, you know, expensive pens and sort of hieroglyphs. Oh, you know, calligraphy rather, you know, in your greeting cards. Yeah. I mean, there's also that, we've read that as well, because they've also rescued board games, apparently.
Yeah.
That's the other thing. But anyway, we're straying off topic.
Well, on that note, Moonpig, I think they obviously have tried to emphasize, you know, the gift side of the business, the non-greetings card side with which you associate them. You know, so attempt perhaps to play both those sides of things, and perhaps the gifts they offer are a little more authentic. But yeah, let's end the podcast. We are running short of time, but just a quick look at some of the looks towards 2023 that we've had in the last few weeks from results. Julian, I know you were talking about this earlier. There's some things you have been looking at, or some noises.
Yeah, there's some interesting stuff. I mean, energy and industrial companies are going to be having a hard time next year. The result that came up this week, that was Victrex, which is everyone's favorite latex company. So, I mean, the interesting thing about that those kind of businesses is they're quite good at managing their cost base. So they only really have to close or open a factory somewhere, and that knocks, you know, they can get some savings out of it. But they're definitely struggling with energy costs, and you know, the longer that goes on, the more attrition it will have. It'll have on the bottom line. So there was that I found quite interesting, and the other one that's coming across is professional services companies next year. So you've got the kind of the lawyer and the business service type companies, and what they were saying was that there could be quite a good counter-cyclical appeal to those type of businesses, because as soon as things go south, everybody starts suing each other, and that generates litigation and professional, you know, other types of professional services, and so those types of businesses tend to take off when the economy isn't doing quite as well. So I thought that was quite an interesting counter growth story. You know, whereas usually it's you know, next year for a lot of people it's just going to be, you know, doom and gloom in a relative sense, you know, if they can't offset their basic costs. So yeah, probably the message is avoid too many industrials, but have a good look at business services, because then that might be where the growth is.
On a corporate level, I suppose, on that legal point, we have had the example in the past couple of days as well, when the growth stops, the suing begins, in terms of Pfizer, BioNTech, counter-suing Moderna over mRNA. So we're very much in the fallout period of that post-vaccine jubilation, I think, now. That does wrap up nicely for today, I think. So thank you to Julian and to Alex and to John. And thank you to you for listening as usual. We will be back next week with another Companies and Markets show.